They moved, save to catch an errant ring or point dramatically at a passing clown. It was a surreal scene of grace and menace, and for some time I don't think I drew a deep breath as my curiosity about the unknown star of the show began to grow. Finally, the clowns began their crescendo in a flashing pinwheel of motion that led them to stand in a line, arms extended, with the metal hoops dangling from a single finger. The unseen ringmaster said simply, "Ladies and gentlemen, it is time for our guest to return to his dark home." The man in black leapt forward in a blur of trailing robes, hurled himself into the line of rings, and vanished in a flare of white light as the clouds dropped to one knee, leaving the rings hovering in space for an incomprehensible second. The roar of the crowd vibrated in my chest like thunder, and as the lights snapped on in a jarring burst of invasive glare, I looked at Gran with my mouth hanging open. What did we just see, Gran? I'm a witch, and I wasn't sure I could pull off something as inexplicable as what we watched under the sticky air of that rippling tent. "Gran, what was that?" I repeated. She tapped her chin thoughtfully and turned to me with her eyes flushed with worry. "A distraction." Chapter 8. Once Bitten. I overheard people talking while I was getting coffee at the Sip and Save, and a sliver of cold crawled up my spine as I realized that Gran had been right. They found a body. To be more specific, the police discovered a man at the dock behind the canoe rental place on the western side of the lake, and something about the hushed tones of the men chatting at the store told me it had been bad. The clerk, Clint, was a young guy who'd been behind me in school by 3 years. We weren't pals, but we were friendly, so I asked him what was up. "County cops were in here with a couple suits from the state. They were pretty tight-lipped, but I got something out of them. You know Edward, the guy that bought the gun store last year?" I nodded. Edward was impossible to miss. He was a Texas transplant, a big dude who everybody liked, loud and brash and friendly to a fault. He owned a canoe rental spot, too, mainly because his divorce cost him dearly and 2 jobs was better than one. His ex-wife lived 1 leg up, and he'd moved here to be closer to his kids. I knew they were young, and a pang of hurt stung me as I wondered what would happen to them. I had a family for my entire life, but those kids' daily existence had just been changed forever. I looked at Clint with a shimmer of tears in my eyes, and he said, "I know. It sucks." "What makes you say it was bad?" I asked, pulling myself together. "Do you know what X sang something?" "It was this word the cops used. And his face, he looked like he was going to be sick. And the dude was no kid," Clint said, waving his frustration at being stymied by the unfamiliar word. "Exsanguinated?" I asked, hoping I was really wrong. Clint brightened, but only slightly. He knew trouble regardless of how many syllables it had. "Yeah, that's it. What's it mean?" I felt the bottom drop out of my stomach and knew I was going to the boat dock. I had to see. Clint's open, honest face looked at me, and I couldn't bring myself to lie. As I turned from the counter, I told him, "It means all the blood was drained from his body." Then I pushed through the glass door into the morning air, my thoughts of Edward and the unseen creature I knew I was going to kill. Chapter 9. Short Girl Problems. In 10 minutes, I was at the dock where Edward had been found, and it was deserted. I walked onto the wooden planks with some trepidation. The aura of death hung in the air, and I felt like I was trespassing on a grave. The short dock was sun-bleached but in good repair, and a boathouse mounted on pontoons floated lazily in the water, tied off with heavy ropes on each corner. The door was closed and locked. No canoes were visible, but the small stand where Edward kept his rental forms and credit card machine was still out, hidden under a happy yellow umbrella that was at least 6 feet across. I like quiet, but the dock was silent, save some modest creaking from errant waves that lapped at the bumpers dangling along the edges. The unnerving stillness made me jumpy, but several deep breaths and a personal admonition got my head in the right place. Green algae colored the white, tubular bumpers with a vivid flash of life. Trees crowded the shore less than 10 feet on either side of the path that led to the dock, and I couldn't hear any ambient noise from the more populous side of the lake. Instinctively, I let charms drop between my fingers and placed a spell on my tongue. The smell of blood whispered to my senses, and I looked down at the boards just past the stand. It always shocked me to realize how little blood can make such an enormous puddle. I knew Edward had been a big man, but I swore that every drop of the 10 pints of blood in an average human was splashed across the wood of that dock. Rust-colored sprays wandered across the boathouse wall, and there was even a staccato pattern of arterial blood on the underside of that ridiculously cheerful umbrella. Other than the wildly dispersed blood, there was no evidence of the man who'd been killed. I felt a chill of reality muscle in on my own desire for a clinical examination of the crime scene, even though I'm far from any kind of investigator. I stepped back into the sun, leaving the now unfriendly confines of the boathouse shadow. Peering up into the glare of the afternoon sun, I thought about Edward. I'm 5 feet tall, and he was easily a foot taller than me, more likely 15 inches. I tried to decrypt the signs of what had transpired on that dock and came up with nothing. There was no ripped fabric or a kicked-in door, no helpful smears of blood or scrawled messages, nothing. Although I was only guessing, it seemed to be rather orderly, at least to my eyes. All of my experience with death involved creatures who share little in common with a robust man from Texas. Therefore, I knew not to apply my own prejudices to what I thought I should be seeing. "Okay, Carly, go low and slow," I told myself, and began looking around at levels even lower than my already diminutive height. Who knew what could be missed by people looking at a scene where all of the gore was up high? I examined every inch of the dock, stepping around one of those enormous wooden spools that rope or wire are sold on. It was covered on one end in fish scales. That must be where the lucky customers cleaned their trout or bullhead or whatever. I stopped. The spool was on its side. I leaned over, verified that one end was used as a bait and cleaning table, and then looked at the other. The wood was clean and relatively unblemished. I grunted with effort to tip the spool upright and noticed a circle on the dock next to the boathouse. The damp outline where it had been sitting for most of the season was dark, but drying in the sun. The spool hadn't been moved for long. The circular outline was still moist to the touch and a little fishy. The spool weighed at least 100 pounds, so it hadn't moved without a lot of help. I put my hand on the rim over the top and began a counterclockwise examination of the surface. It was a predictable pastiche of knife cuts and odd scratches, just as I expected. Except for the claw marks. I knew they were claw marks because I have a giant cat, and I live in the mountains, and I know what animals do to wood when they get angry. The gouges were bright scars in the heavy pine. There were 8 in all, with a hint of a 9th. They were too big to be a raccoon, but far too small for a bear. I stared at the spool now standing upright and thought about something that only a short girl would know. Without a thought, I stepped up onto the spool and looked down from my newfound vantage point. If Edward had been there, I would have simply stepped off and been on his back like a demonic papoose, but I knew that was wrong. Whoever had stood on that spool leaped off with enormous force, tearing into the wood and hitting Edward with enough impact that it made a big, strong guy disoriented enough to be murdered like a lamb without even fighting back. Unless... I looked at the wall, noting small shadows in the angled sunlight. They were impact craters, more specifically, knuckle marks. Edward must have swung hard at something and missed, probably several times, judging by dents in the soft wood of the shiplap siding. He not only fought back, but it had gone on long enough for him to throw a series of haymakers that might have killed a normal human being. I leaned into the wall again in order to put my eyes at a better angle. The divots from his fists weren't deep, but by getting close, I could see most of them. As I hovered inches from the warm wood, a light touch brushed my cheek, and I damned near fell off the spool. After the requisite hysterical I stepped in a spiderweb dance, I slowed my spastic gyrations to a stop and did the only logical thing. I looked around to see if anyone had seen me freak out, and then I began to look for the spider. I turned and peered at the boathouse wall, which was now glowing with the full radiance of a summer sun. No spider, no web. Not even a place for there to be a web. But there was still something glinting, like a nearly invisible dancing ribbon. I reached out and plucked two long hairs from a nail that extended out a quarter inch or so. They'd hung up after being pinched between the rusted head and a sliver of pale wood. The hair was indeterminate color, 2 feet long, and silken. My breath caught in that perfect hiccup of rage that only hits you in traffic or at the driver's license bureau. I could feel my cheeks go pink in a flash. Short girl problems take all forms, and I knew one particular short girl who had both claws and long hair. She also had a reason to kill. I felt a spell sizzle in my throat and bit it back with righteous fury. My feet hit the deck, and I was running, charms in hand and blood in my eyes. I was going to find Anna, and I was going to kill her, no matter what. Chapter 10. Walking Mad. My small feet were punishing the trail when an incongruous series of chimes interrupted my righteous fury. Gran was calling. I drew up, panting, and pulled my phone out. Hello? To my credit, it was less than a gasp, but I knew she would ask what I'd been doing. There was an uncomfortable silence in which I could hear breathing judgment into the phone receiver. Old phones are optimal for imparting all manner of insults, especially when you know you're guilty. I was feeling somewhat put upon before she even spoke a word. Dear, may I ask what you're doing that would involve you being winded? Is there a bear nearby? Perhaps a rogue wolverine, or one of those aggressive squirrels with whom you seem to have an everlasting confrontation? Gran's voice was pleasant, making her inquiry all the more maddening. That squirrel had it coming. He knew I was saving that pumpkin. It had not been a proud moment, because I not only argued with a rodent, but lost. Badly. Indeed. So, a bear. Gran fell silent while I caught my breath. No, not exactly. You know Edward? Texas Edward? I elaborated. I take it there's bad news? Gran asked, her voice grim. He's dead. I just left there, and I think you were embroiled in rage that has no basis in evidence and went off to commit a crime against mankind because of a moment of pique? Gran's words oozed amazement. She really knew how to deliver a guilt bomb without raising her voice in the slightest. It was a skill I found both admirable and irritating, especially when she was right. Like now. Well, when you put it that way, I sound, I don't know. I struggled to find a term that didn't fully illuminate my guilt. Like one of those squirrels but without a tail, chittering and angry and about to go do something wholly inadvisable, Gran offered helpfully. I let a gusty sigh whoosh past my lips in a flutter. It was most unladylike, but no one was around. Yes, sort of. Well, exactly like that. I have good reason, though. Do tell. The invitation was pleasant. The commanding tone was unspoken, but understood. The crime scene, Gran. It was awful. I let the memory rush back in a tide of red loops where Edward's body had wildly declared his last act, and my eyes began to mist. Tell me more, Carly, Gran said, and this time her direction was gentle. There was a sort of table knocked over. I stood on it to, I don't know, get an angle. and found some long hairs stuck in the wooden siding of the boathouse. Long, silky hairs. I sighed, feeling the anger leave me hollow and a bit tired. It's Anna. I know it. So? I left the conclusion hanging. Gran knew my feelings about Anna. She understood my need to protect what I had with Wulfric. Gran said nothing, compelling me to fill the silence with more of my own conclusions. I was heading to the rock where I met her, on the loop trail that skirts the first ridge above town, I admitted. And you thought that screaming distance was the best place to commit a capital offense against a single mother who would love nothing more than to see you dead, hopefully before she or her pack could shift into their primal forms and overwhelm your power with brute force? Gran asked archly. Yeah, well, in retrospect, I kind of wish I hadn't started running. I was bitterly disappointed in myself. Gran's tone wasn't helping, even if she was right. Carly, how close are you to the place where Anna met you before? Gran asked. Her tone was neutral. Close, about 100 yards, give or take. I looked around, assessing the territory. I knew the loop trail well, and my estimate seemed spot on. Then we can assume that any shifter will have heard you by now, so you can do away with any pretense of stalking. If you won't turn and come home, may I suggest at the very least that you walk there calmly and announce your presence? Gran asked, and I realized she was right. I was actually too far from town to make a run for it if Anna's pack decided to surround me. My error came home to roost with the weight of the first afternoon shadows, and I knew that I'd better clear my head. I needed a quiet mind. Gran, I'm too close to leave. I have to focus. There was silence on the line. Then she said, Sound. Prepare spells of sound. You'll want confusion, not death. You cannot kill that woman, Carly, no matter what you think has happened. Do you understand? I did. I'd been about to commit murder based on emotion and lack of control. I'd reduced myself to an animal state by the abandonment of my familial magic. There would be time for shame later. I told Gran I loved her, hung up, and cleared my mind. Noise and fury, but no death. I squared my shoulders, drew power into my mind, and let my feet move forward to the outpost where I knew Anna would be waiting. Chapter 11. In Hair Defense. Anna was waiting for me on the same rock where I'd been tempted to roast her once before. She was holding her head in her hands, eyes downcast. An aura of fear and uncertainty clung to her before we even made eye contact. This was a different woman. Where was the long hair, the arrogance? This girl seemed meek, even frightened. I stopped 10 feet away and addressed her. Don't think cutting your hair off will absolve you of murder. I don't give a damn how sorry you are, shifter. I spat the last word as a curse, feeling the power flash in my eyes. She didn't do it. His eyes met mine, and I froze. It was Anna, but it wasn't. At my expression, he smiled, a slow, sad ghost of happiness lasting only a fugitive minute. He looked at the question on my face, and the smile returned. I'm her brother, he said, answering the question that died on my lips. I believe you've been sensing me, but I haven't wanted to confront you. Not yet, anyway, but the situation has changed. I looked him over in detail. He was small, but still taller than Anna. His build was light and graceful. I pictured him running like a deer, and the image fit with a satisfying click. His black hair was short, his eyes were dark, and the planes of his face verged on beautiful. I stepped closer so that our eyes were even with each other. I felt the need to look beyond the wary grace of him and see what was happening behind that stare. Why don't you start by telling me 2 things? I asked. I wasn't about to be knocked off my track by his unusual presence. I'm a nerd to the weird. It's part of my job description. He raised a shoulder and a shrug. What's your name? And who killed Edward, if it wasn't your sister? I asked him. I thought the direct route was best and knew Gran would approve since it didn't involve using a spell strike to get my point across. He slid down the rock to his feet in a move that was identical to Anna's liquid grace.
Walk with me to town and we can talk. I'm Alex.
And as for your second question, I know it wasn't Anna. His eyes never left mine as he spoke. If he was a liar, he was damned good. Like ex-boyfriend wanting back in good. I gathered my thoughts as we fell into an easy pace toward town. If not your sister, then who? I didn't change the question, but I didn't abandon it either. I wanted him to answer.
That's the wrong question, and you know it. You went to the scene, right? That's why you were fighting mad when you came up the trail.
You wanted to kill my sister because you thought she did something horrible.
That, or you're just mad all the time.
He judged me with a long gaze, then shook his head in dismissal.
That's not your style. You must have seen something really bad. What made you think Anna did it?
I pulled the long, twisting hairs from my pocket and let them drift on the breeze while pinched between my fingers. He made no move to touch them, but nodded in understanding.
You see why I might think that? Yeah, but murder. What did you see?
His face was open, curious. There was no hint of guilt or hesitancy in his body language. He genuinely wanted to know. I replayed the sparse scene, made comically horrid by the mirth of wildly sprayed arterial blood.
Why? Did I ask the wrong question?
Again, he shrugged in a minimal way that suggested he was used to being quiet.
You said, if not Anna, then who? When the question should be what? Right?
I had to agree. It wasn't a human attack in any way. I sighed, feeling that familiar sense of the unknown percolate in my stomach like a toxic butterfly. I hate not knowing what's happening under my nose, especially when good people are at risk. Since Edward was dead, I'd say this situation was well past a mere problem. This was an attack, and Halfway, and its environs, are under the specific care of my family. Our magic is a kind of promise, a covenant, if you will, and we take it as seriously as any natural law. Our promise simply is, and nothing can contravene that bond without drawing my attention, and Gran's. That's our family position, and it's non-negotiable. I realized rather suddenly that Alex and I were back in town, leading me to conclude that Alex was capable of being silent when needed. That's a rare quality, and I looked at the elegant young man with more than a little respect.
Want to grab a beer and talk it over? We can hit the Pines and talk.
I promise, Alex. I'll listen. The Pines was part hole in the wall, part hiding place, about 3 blocks up from the diner. It was one of 3 bars in town, and for privacy, it couldn't be beat. Alex responded with another minimal shrug. He clearly hadn't gotten the chatterbox gene that infected Anna, and I found myself adding that quality to his already considerable list of reason Alex is better than Anna, as I'd coined it. We began to descend the path that intersected with Main Street, preparing to pass by a large, over-decorated public restroom that squatted beside the trailhead like a refugee from a movie set. The Adirondack theme was a touch heavy-handed. I mean, do you really need a silhouette of a lady moose to indicate which bathroom to use? It was gaudy and oddly lonely, given the position. Town people never used it. We left the austere interiors to the tourists who got caught short before starting their modest hike into the more well-worn section of the looping trail. I pride myself on being decisive. When we saw the girl standing next to the faux log exterior of the restrooms, I immediately took in her appearance, the tears, and the aura of exhaustion that hung around her like a record of the past 10 minutes. She was young, just in her teens, skinny, and still possessed of that innocent hue that kids inexplicably seem to lose overnight. Clear braces gleamed on her teeth, and the blotches across her face told the tale of a long, ugly cry that was only beginning to subside. She rubbed her bony shoulder absently with one pale arm. There was a hint of sunburn on her skin, and she wore shorts and beat-up chucks that made it look like she knew her way around a field or two. Alex, meet me at the Pines in 10, I said, cutting my eyes at the girl. He raised his brows, took in the scene, and surmised that I was going to do girl stuff, thus excusing him from whatever was happening in the next few minutes. With an extrovert like Anna as his sister, his reaction came as no surprise. He'd probably had a life filled with extravagant public scenes, and the quiet young man before me would have hated that, I could tell.
Okay.
One word, one glance, and he walked off like a wraith, carefully avoiding any eye contact with the girl who now looked up in moderate alarm. With a snap decision based on instinct, I called out to Alex, "I'll track you down later. Cancel the beer for now." He turned back to me, and I willed him towards understanding with my pleading eyes. He nodded softly and finished his slinking departure. She was much more than just a girl. She was a unicorn. No, not that kind. In my family, we have terms that apply to certain events or people who fall outside the grind of ordinary daily life. A unicorn is that hint or person or thing that delivers a magical being into your lap without lifting one finger. A unicorn is a mistake, an oopsie, or in some cases, the way to answer questions that might have lain dormant for centuries. Gran and I love unicorns. They make protecting our lands that much easier. I drew my conclusion about the girl based on some quick assessment. Also, the simple truth that the bulk of the crime in Halfway is magical in origin. Believe me, it keeps our sheriff bored while I'm busy. Usually. I looked her over once more, squared my shoulders, and began to approach her, but not before smiling. Smiles are good. Frowns are bad. What if your face stayed that way for a few centuries? I've seen such a thing. Oof, not the way to spend your time in the ever after. With a slow walk, I stepped down the path to the girl, and hopefully some answers. Chapter 12. Unicorn Justice. Hi, I'm Carly. Are you okay? I asked, hanging back a step or two just to let the girl warm up to me. She went rigid like a deer preparing to bolt, then looked me over in detail with wide brown eyes. Her dark blonde hair was pulled back in a ponytail. Everything about her said she was on the cusp of going into the truly awkward years of her life. For now, she just seemed a bit tall, innocent, and scared. With a near comical sniffle, she drew her head up, thought better of it, and fought back another wave of tears. I'm not okay today. The admission was painfully honest. I took another step closer, hands up, with my palms spread. What's your name, honey? I live here. Are you visiting? I knew she was, but wanted to draw her out. She'd clearly been schooled by a parent or two about the presence of strangers. The internal fight over whether she should speak to me went out in my favor. Amy. My name is Amy. She looked down, her bottom lip in a death grip between her teeth. When her eyes rose, tears welled anew. My parents are over where we're staying. Will you walk me there? She tossed a look of unalloyed fear over my shoulder. Into the woods. I looked behind in response. Her fear was palpable and fogged the clean air around us. My breath caught slightly at the sight of innocuous green trees. From her look, I'd expected nothing short of a dragon behind me. That wasn't entirely out of the question, but I found the prospect highly unlikely. Amy, what are you scared of? I put my hand on her arm with my lightest touch. After an initial flinch, she sagged into me, and I realized she was taller and lighter than me. I'm not far removed from that kind of childhood myself, but she seemed small and horribly scared. Her ribs shook with a deep quiver that told me she was on the verge of losing it, and this time she might not be standing when the crying was over. I know fear, and it was worming its way through her body like a toxin. I looked into her eyes and smiled in what I hoped was my most maternal gaze. I know it might have been a touch forced. Not even Gus believes I've a maternal bone in my body, but it seemed to create a bridge between us, even if it was tenuous at best. A man. He was here. He was on the roof when I came out, and he jumped down, like a shadow. She looked upward again, but I pulled her chin down and reinforced my sense of capability and caring. Tell me about him. If he'd been on the roof, I immediately knew it was no man. Neither had been the creature who killed Edward. He was short, and he stank, like he was sick or something. He was all sweaty, and his hands were, like, all long. He looked like he was homeless. She trailed off, hiccuping, into a cry that felt painful to me, and I was only holding her. Did he hurt you? I began to look at her exposed skin as discreetly as possible. There didn't seem to be any blood, or anything obviously wrong. She shook her head. He grabbed me, but it was just like he was made out of stone or something. Held me, and then he kissed my cheek and told me something. His tongue was in my ear, and I don't know why. With an effort, she gathered herself. Amy was tough, I decided. Go on, honey. This is all helpful. I smiled again. It was no lie. She was helping me with every fact she could deliver. Where are you staying? She hesitated as her instinctive fear kicked in gear again, then looked at me and rendered her judgment. My family rented one of the Limberlost cabins for the week. Mom and Dad are there. And my sister. She added with that perfect disgust that only a sibling can vocalize. Older sister? I asked, smiling. 3 years. She likes boys and her phone, and she totally doesn't talk to me unless I'm in the bathroom for more than 10 seconds. Her eyes rolled as she told me that last tidbit, and I found myself laughing despite her state of upset. That won me some points because Amy calmed visibly and wiped at her swollen nose. Would you like me to walk you there, and we can talk about what happened? I live here in Halfway, and I promise you no one will bother us. I held out my hand, and after a gravid second, she took it. Kids really are tougher than anyone thinks. The Limberlost cabins are where city folks come to pretend they're roughing it in the mountains. There are 2 rows of 12 adorably Adirondack-looking bungalows that are too nice to be cabins and too small to be actual homes. For added authenticity, there are community showers and bathrooms at the end of snow-white gravel paths. The cabins are to the north end of town, just past the city building and a small theater that does a booming business in the winter and stays admirably afloat during the summer. People tend to seize the day, so to speak, and summer is not likely to be ignored by being inside. Not when there's so much to do and see right outside your own door. During the 15-minute walk, Amy filled me in on the details of her attack. I stopped her now and then, asking for clarification, but for the most part I simply let her speak into the comfortable silence between us. She was a sweet kid, sort of funny, and on the cusp of discovering that there was more to the world than her own room and her cat. I hoped that this day wouldn't stay with her any longer than was necessary, so I decided to play the badass in order to set her mind at ease. The man who grabbed her was an Indian of some sort. That much was obvious from her description. He was also not a man. Amy described a necklace he wore in such detail that I felt I could locate it in the dark. A leather string held a gleaming white shark tooth around his neck, upon which was inscribed an infinity symbol. Initially, her description of a figure 8 on its side had left me wondering if it was a number, but further questions clarified what it was, and I moved on to his actual words. In point of fact, he mostly scared her, saying precious little. Her fear colored the memory, but I knew that Amy was marked as a victim of some sort. And with vampires not entirely unknown to our area, it made sense that he might be back to pay her a visit. That's where I come into the picture, because any immortal creature on my family land, or Wolfric's for that matter, stands there at our pleasure and not their own. Don't even get me started about what Gran might do. She's the velvety hammer in our family. She's totally willing to do anything to keep Halfway safe, but with perfect manners and a smile. After extracting a promise of silence, I told Amy in my most serious voice that I would watch over her all night and into the morning. Her eyes had gone round at that, and she hugged me like kids do, with that flailing motion that means they're not concerned with how they look, but only how they feel. I love that kind of honesty, and there were tears in my eyes when she went to her cabin, number 3, left side, and stepped into the garish wooden door. I pulled my phone out and told Gran the details, waiting to hear her advice on the matter. When she stayed silent, I asked, "Gran, what do you think?" Again, the silence lagged, but then she cleared her throat and I could feel her anger.
"My temptation is to do something inadvisable. I'd best leave this matter to you, dear. If the vampires have abrogated our treaty, then we shall look at options."
The way she said options made me think that it would be decidedly unhealthy to be a vampire in the Adirondacks if she decided to reintroduce certain aspects of a long-standing treaty. These are our lands. My family controls the magical nature of what occurs here in Halfway and the lake area. For a creature like a vampire to violate that trust is something akin to a message. It's also incredibly stupid, given that my grandmother hasn't flexed her magical muscles in years. She's frightening when her spells come out to play. "Okay, Gran, I love you. I'm going to watch her tonight and get some answers from this Indian. He's not Huron or Mohawk, I can tell from the girl's description. But if he isn't local, then he's here without our permission." I let air rush from my lips as I considered what to do next. Gran took care of that indecision with a simple command. "That's easy, dear. If he is an outsider and he is harming children, kill him." Her words were stone-covered iron, and I twitched at their power. I knew she was right. Her certainty was a physical law, and I found myself nodding at the phone.
"Consider it done, Gran, and if I can, I'll get some answers," I said.
"Do that, Carly. Oh, and one more thing. I'll feed your cat. Be safe, dear. Call me at dawn. It'll be over then." She clicked off, and I was left smiling at the phone, now more convinced that someone immortal was about to have a miserable evening. Chapter 13. Still Waters. There's a knack to waiting. It's simple biology that humans detest waiting, except for the British, for whom standing in line is a kind of national pastime. Excuse me, they enjoy queuing up, as our cousins over the pond are fond of saying. Regardless of my nationality, I have a particular tactic that stems from my training as a witch. I looked around at the general layout of the cabins and selected my hiding place, marked it in my mind, and did the only logical thing. I went to get snacks. The Convenience Mart is one block up across the street, so I sauntered my way in a pace that was guaranteed to let me be consumed by the rush of tourists on their way north or south in the main pathway that ran along the lake. I selected from the critical food groups, those being jerky, salty chips, and chocolate, then added bottled water and a giant energy drink. I can cast a spell of wakefulness on myself, but doing so will degrade my power base. I didn't want to waste the magic on something that an energy drink could achieve, albeit with a little more twitching. Girding my loins for battle yet again, I slid discreetly behind the cabins to a row of spruce, just as the sun was beginning to set in a wash of gray and rust. There were feathered clouds to the east, and I smelled the hints of a fireplace from nearby. All of the cabins had them, and people tended to feel that unless they had a fire going, they weren't really roughing it. Never mind that it was 70 degrees outside, or there was a restaurant less than a stone's throw from their door. These were city folks on an adventure, and I wouldn't disabuse them of their illusions. I know the power of perception, and I respect it. I let the night close around me, finished my second candy bar, no judging now, and crossed my legs, palms up, in preparation for spellcasting. The magic I was going to assemble would create a permeable barrier between me and the night, and I began to quiet my mind in gentle steps that drew me softly from the bustle of the day. Eyes closed, I reached out with my mind and let my power come to rest lightly on my tongue. After a whisper, I began to weave a dark fabric of sullen lines that connected, ducked under each other, and knotted at the end of each waving row. It was a garment of silence that settled around me without impact or light. I felt the surface of the earth beneath me, and keyed to the gentle waves of energy that spoke of life and death and the things that hovered between. The rocking motion began to still, and in a moment I knew that I was invisible to the world. With a soundless flutter, my creation of woven energy stilled the waters of my mind, and I faded from view. A ghost, but one with a bite. I was undetectable, but I could see. My eyes snapped open, and I began to watch with an intensity that only witches and predators can muster. The moon rose, stars began to flicker, and during the small hours, the world descended into the moments of my mind. The witching hour. It's neither late nor early, but on the cusp of a time when animal or human brains cannot ascertain what they should be doing, so they become inert. Weak. Vulnerable. I knew that was when he would appear, and I was right. Predators share methods, if not reasons, so it was easy for me to track the shadow that moved without sound across the chilled grass of the manicured lawn before me. It looked like a man. I took in certain peculiar traits from his silhouette alone. There was a roll to his gait. He had powerful, columnar legs, and he wasn't tall. A broad chest and burly shoulders molded him as a person of immense strength. The moon cast shadows on the planes of his face, and his eyes lurked as mere glimmers and shadowed nooks beneath a strong brow. His silence was total, his motion predatory. I knew then he was no man, but I reached that critical decision to let my spell speak first in order to subdue him, if I could. I waved a negligent hand at him and let my spell smash into his feet, flipping him up and over in a wrenching arc. Before he could move, I stood holding one hand outward, charms tinkling together in the light of the moon. "If you wish to live, you will stay still." My voice was cold. My anger was not. To my utter surprise, he obeyed, even going so far as raising one shoulder in a tiny shrug, which was a feat, given his bulging muscles. I could see that he was deeply tanned, and his teeth leapt out at me like mirthful beacons. He was smiling. "I choose to obey." His voice was light, nearly mocking, and completely without accent, save a sing-song quality to his speech that told me he knew other languages. They were old tongues, if I made my mark. "That's good. Stay seated, but get comfortable. If you even twitch, I'll set you ablaze. If you make a move, there won't be anything left to burn. Got it?" I asked. He folded his legs neatly as an answer and waited. After I cocked my head to examine him thoroughly, I asked him, "Who are you?" The shark-tooth necklace was tied around his neck. It moved up and down slightly with his breathing. In the dim light, I could see it well enough to know this was certainly the man Amy described to me earlier. "You could not pronounce my name," he said, brimming with confidence. Names are powerful things. His sidestep of my acquiring some power over him was deft, but not unnoticed. I took his glib assumption of my inability to speak complex words as a sign of overconfidence. "Fine by me," I decided. If he chose to regard me as weak, I'd exploit that supposition at every turn. Witches are sneaky that way. We use every little advantage, and then some. "What shall I call you, then?" I persisted.
"Philip, that will do. And you are?"
He raised his brows at me over a smile. He was rather cocksure for a man staring at a ring of charms loaded with enough magic to burn down the forest. I waited to respond, just to let it be known I was in charge. Interrogation is in the details. "Why did you scare that girl today, Philip?" I was going to ask one question at a time, just to judge his answers. He flicked long fingers dismissively. "Boredom." When it became obvious he wasn't going to say anything else, I shook my head in a rueful twist, my lips pulled sardonically to the side. His eyes narrowed as he began to process what I was doing. "Philip, I understand that we don't know one another. I can also grasp that you're an archaic pig who thinks women can't say big, scary, polysyllabic words like your name. Are you with me so far? I asked, and his shoulders tightened at my flippant tone.
Perhaps I do not wish for you to know my name.
His expression grew mulish, casting more shadows on his face in the rare light of the stars. That isn't really relevant, Philip. You see, you're on my family lands. You're clearly inhuman, and you assaulted a child today. I began, but he interrupted me heatedly.
I did not assault the girl. I spoke to her and—
No! My voice cracked with certainty. You taunted her, maybe got off on it a little. Then you lay hands on her in a direct violation of the law, both human and witch. Your simple presence here is causing me some concern, which in turn causes my grandmother to be concerned. You see how this might raise my ire when you deliver virtual grunts for answers to my questions? He waited a moment before responding.
I will try to be more elaborate with my answers.
Good. I smiled at him for a flash, then got back to business. Let's set the issue of your assault to one side for the moment. Why are you here?
Interesting question. No, I'm not dodging you. I'm contemplating your observational skills. You didn't ask me what I am, nor do you seem concerned. That tells me as much about you as you know about me. A sort of unspoken trade, don't you think?
Philip grinned in the gloom, and I could see the points of his teeth. A vampire, and not young. I'd been right to hold him at arm's length. When I stayed silent, he went on.
These are your lands. By what right?
I gave him a murderous glare, letting my charms clink together in an unspoken message. What an unwise question, but I'll answer it. My voice was dripping frost, but a hot flush was creeping up my cheeks. I do not claim ownership of these lands. My family claims stewardship as well as protective status over the residents herein. That would include visitors like Amy, the young woman you attacked. He looked at me, adjusting his opinion. My use of the term family was not accidental.
Before you attack me, allow me to ask, am I not a visitor?
He smiled, but it did not reach his eyes. You are indeed, but like a rabid animal, I have no problem removing you from this place, by force if necessary. Now, enough dancing. I don't want to waste time asking you a litany of questions. I'd rather you simply tell me who you are in detail and why you are here. We'll address the issue of your behavior momentarily. Philip lifted his palms and grinned.
That's not fair.
He exhaled, looking up into the sky.
I've traveled some distance in order to lay claim to something which has been taken from me. It is... I cannot call it an object. It's much more complicated than that. Do you understand the power structure of vampire clans?
I nodded slowly. Somewhat. Whose clan do you represent?
I am of House Tidewater, but I do not represent them. I am the last member, so in truth I am Tidewater.
The vampire who called himself Philip looked upward again.
I expected the stars to be different, but they are the same cold, distant points.
Is this the part where you wax poetic about the mysteries of the universe, charm me with some legend about the stars being souls trapped in heaven, and we forget all about your assault on that girl? I asked, a smile creeping into my voice. I enjoy folklore, especially when it's being used as a distraction.
I may look the part of a savage, but I respect nuclear fusion as a force of creation. No, I enjoy the poetry of lies that we use to describe that which is unknown, but I trust fact over myth.
Philip said with an impudent grin. It made him look young, and I could see an echo of the man who must have been before he was turned. A vampire and a skeptic? That's rare earth indeed. On a long shot, let me ask if you're hungry. I stared at his eyes to see if he reacted to the thought of feeding. If he was in command of his inner lust, then there was another reason for his attack. I intended to understand it before he was done talking.
Yes.
One word, and his eyes cut away from me in a mix of shame and admission.
But that isn't why you attacked the girl, is it? I said. More statement than question.
He measured me before answering. True, but what leads you to that conclusion?
I started ticking points off on my fingers. She's a kid. There's no way she could fight you off should you choose to feed. It was daylight, and that generally meant you would have a suicidal need to hunt. You don't. Shall I go on, or do you want to tell me the reason you chose a gangly teenager to scare, knowing that she would tell her parents and cause some moderate stir in our quiet little town? He laughed then, warmly, and when his eyes returned to me, there was genuine respect in them.
You are quick, witch. And yes, you are correct. My, interaction with the girl was designed to draw attention, not from the town, but from certain visitors in the town.
Other vampires? I asked, immediately thinking of the danger to Halfway. I didn't like the direction such thoughts took me. Wherever vamps ran unchecked, you ended up with large-scale destruction, one murder at a time. Their presence was like a slow, rising tide that never stopped until everyone was underwater. I knew firsthand from my deceased friend Jim that vampires were still taking entire villages if given the chance. Jim Dietrich, now gone, told of an entire village in Afghanistan that had simply vanished. I explained that the people of that ill-fated town struck a deal with a vampire. The agreement collapsed, and nearly 60 families were consumed by something that probably hadn't been human for centuries. I understand vampires and their territorial nature, along with their complicated social interactions they engage in with each other. It's an arcane type of posturing that is more animal than human, and I'm blessed by the earth and stars that Wulfric is half-human and all good. His vampire half is kept in the background, like a muted television, and the man I care for is nothing like any vampire I've ever met.
Philip nodded. I can tell by your expression that you think me more animal than man.
I said nothing. Even in the starlight, my thoughts were easy to read.
I am not a beast. I was once a king, you know. I've watched my land and people be ground into dust over the centuries, and now I'm forced to beg for my blood gift, as would a filthy pauper.
His knuckles cracked as he rolled his fists into angry knots.
From 300 proud vampires to me, and now I am summoned like a dog for the right to feed myself.
Blood gift? What is that, Philip? I asked. The term was new and ominous. The vampire did something so human, I had a moment of vertigo. He spat on the ground while cursing in a liquid tongue I didn't recognize.
It is. When my clan began to wane, we were forced to seek permission to hunt. Our own territories were being stolen from us all over again. You cannot imagine the violation of such a thing, witch. It is inhuman to endure such slavery.
I stared at him, a smile spreading on my face at the stupidity of his words.
You mean like, I don't know, being fed upon without permission? By some blood-sucking undead who regards you as glorified cattle?
That kind of slavery, Philip? I said, my tone acid. If he thought I was a sympathetic ear for his clan's fall, he wasn't just wrong, he was delusional. I found myself wondering if vampires could go crazy. I know that sleeping all day leaves me irritable and on edge. Plus, vampires don't really eat, and they're terrible at social situations. I mean, who wants to go for centuries without the possibility of a waffle or a lunch date?
Not me.
Philip grew dangerously still, and I let a spell build to critical mass ready for his attack. It didn't arrive because the vampire demonstrated a mastery of his anger I wouldn't have thought possible. Generally, vampires of great age have deteriorated into one of two permanent states. The first being a kind of sage in which their mastery over their appetites is nearly complete. You can tell that type. They have an aura of calm around that isn't really evil, just reeking of age and experience. Those I can tolerate, I think. The second kind is far more dangerous.
They're well on their slide into some kind of barely controlled animal state, in which their bodies have become little more than a skin covering for a coiling mass of hunger. They kill without thought, or even malice, really, because the echoes of the human they used to be are lost to the punishing drumbeat of their need for blood. Philip struck me as neither, so I wasn't sorry about needling him to the point of violence. I was curious about what lay under his veneer of humanity, and in my own way, cut him to see what he was made of. His reaction was most welcome, despite me being in close proximity to a vampire of his age. Simply put, I was right, and he knew it. Indulging him in some fantasy about his status as a victim was almost comical. I thought about how many unwielding necks he'd pierced during the years of his eternal hunt, and felt myself stiffen once again, the anger at such wanton disregard for life giving me a stinging rush of anger. After a long moment, he sighed. It was a bitter sound, and it seemed quite human. "I will never be used to my status as a relic," he began. That got my attention. In my experience, vampires are usually so in love with their own power, they think the sun rises and sets on them. If they can tolerate sunlight, that is, which is a neat trick that more than a few of them have mastered. But back to their status as epic narcissists. You don't think they all dress that way simply because they love vintage opera costumes, do you? No, they're arrogant, prideful, and powerful enough to be disconnected from their own mortality by an endless thirst for blood and dominance. I tilted my head at Philip and pressed him on his appearance. "Let me explain why I'm so unimpressed with your arrival. I got a note indicating that there are vampires keeping prisoners on my family land. Do you know what that means?"
"I can surmise. I assume that's a violation of your coven's policy," he said.
There was no hint of avoidance in his answer. "That's one way to put it. Keeping someone as living food is cause for summary justice on the part of my family. But it doesn't end there, Philip. Are you aware of retroactive magic?" I asked him. When he shrugged, I explained, "Witches are like badgers. We're most powerful in our own dens. Think of these mountains as my den," I said, waving grandly. "And my familial magic is intensified by the location of it when cast. So my spells can be shaped to act like bloodhounds. They don't just destroy the being who commits a crime against our people. The magic actually becomes a metaphysical force that will seek out the entire source of this affront. Oh, it's true that a really skilled caster might interpret some of the effects, but over time my spell will worry at their defenses until it finds a crack. Then, anyone or anything associated with the abuse of unnatural power in our lands will be killed. No warning, no gradual erosion of their powers, just instantaneous death. Or true death, in the case of your kind. And there is little that can be done about it. So when you tell me that you are the Tidewater Clan, I have to say that I'm not entirely saddened by that, because some other clan is keeping humans as cattle. On my family lands. Do you see what you've walked into, Philip?" I was standing close enough to him that I watched his eyes widen at the threat in my voice.
"I keep no humans, nor have I ever. I spent my mortal years as a kind of slave myself, and would not visit such a thing upon others."
He raised a hand as a kind of vow. I laughed in his face. "Do you think you're the first vampire to tell me that you're different? You're right about one thing. Purebloods are slaves, but only to their lust. If you don't have human blood in your veins, you can't beat this thing, Philip. It owns you. But you already know that, don't you? So why are you trying to convince me that you are one of the good ones? I have a blood-smeared note telling me that there are people in danger right this second. Do you propose to help me free them?"
"I don't even know where these supposed prisoners are," he protested.
I tapped a finger against my temple. "Then think. You're a vampire who has come to my town for some purpose that you still haven't revealed. So how about if you answer that, because vamps run together, like wargs or ghouls? You're never solo."
"I am,"
He stood, arms crossed. I conceded his point for the moment. Yes, but you're meeting someone, aren't you? Why? My fingers twitched. I wanted to send a ray of sun into this guy, and soon, unless he gave up the whole mystery man routine. I hate